Literally from the North Shore presents Dean Hovey's book Whistling Sousa in 14 episodes. This is episode 7.
Like I told you, Doc, the clarinets are mad at the trombones, and most of the women are jealous of Sheila's appearance. I think most of the band is creeped out about Jesse's sex change, but none of those things are out of the ordinary. When you throw together any group of talented musicians, there's always friction. Talented people are different. But they don't kill each other, Len said. Not usually, Brian replied. Can I go now? Doc's office is giving me claustrophobia. He looked around nervously. Was this a broom closet? Len pulled the door open, and Brian left with a wave. Why does Brian call you Doc? Len asked. He found out I used to be a Navy corpsman, and he started calling me Doc. Len nodded and closed the door. Do you think Brian is being straight with us? He asked as he clamped the pipe stem between his teeth and took out the lighter. He waved me off when I started to protest. He lit the pipe, inhaled deeply, and blew the smoke at the ceiling vent. I looked at the smoke alarm in the opposite corner and wondered how much smoke was required to trigger the alarm. I don't know Brian very well, but he's been straightforward with me. The first time we met, he brought music for the concert and told me he was unhappy, even though he was the backup conductor. I'd been asked to step in. Once he said his piece, he told me what I needed to know and has been very nice. Well, aside from the deluge of corny tuba player jokes. I went to high school with his older brother, Mike. I mostly remember Brian as a pesky little brother who wanted to tag along with the big kids. I see him around town occasionally and say hi, but I've never really known him. I know that I've never arrested him or any of his kids, so he can't be too much of a troublemaker. Brian warned me about Sheila before the first performance. Warned you about what? Len asked. Like he said, Sheila would be late, and would be dressed in a way that would irritate the women in the band. I have to say that he was right on all counts, based on the number of people I saw rolling their eyes when she came on stage. It's interesting, he mentioned that the women are most irritated with her, Len said, taking another drag on the pipe. Poisons are most often a weapon of choice for female murderers and suicides. I'd classify a peanut as a poison to someone with an allergy. I did a quick mental count and said, that eliminates the 20 men, about 40% of the band. I wonder how many people knew about Sheila's nut allergy, Len asked. Before the HIPAA laws, I would have included anyone who works at a hospital or clinic as likely suspects, but the patient privacy laws have really put a clamp on the amount of patient information that's accessible to medical personnel. I don't know, Len. She could have declined nuts at a party or bar, mentioning her allergy. Or it could be a waiter at a restaurant where she made sure there were no peanuts in her Kung Pao chicken. Are there any waitresses or nurses in the band? Len asked. I have no idea. I've only conducted them once, and I don't know the names of more than a handful of them. The season-ending concert is next Thursday in the band shell. That gives you 4 days before the concert to check it out, he said, as he tucked his pipe away and walked out the door. Why am I checking it out? I yelled after him. You're the detective. Wendy swept in on Len's heels. I smell tobacco smoke. Wendy is militantly anti-smoking and shows up unexpectedly at inconvenient times. This was an inconvenient time for her to appear. Len Rents just left. It's not a big deal, I said. It is a big deal. Secondhand smoke kills millions of people a year and is the primary cause of most bladder cancer. It's also against the law to smoke inside a public building. You are abetting him. Her round face was turning red and she was shaking a rolled-up newspaper at me as if I were a misbehaving dog. Len's gone. I'll remind him if he comes back. I got it. No smoking. It's the law. Wendy lost her head of steam and said, all right. She unfolded the newspaper and flattened it, showing me the crossword puzzle. The clue for 34 across is a drawer in a drawer? The answer is 9 letters long. Underwear, I said. She counted off the spaces and then looked at me skeptically. Have you already done the crossword today? No, I don't do crosswords. She leaned against the door and filled the letters in the spaces. She tapped her pencil on the paper a couple times and said, It seems to fit. I shrugged. Okay, is there something else you wanted? No, that was pretty much it. She turned and left. A little headache started creeping up my forehead, and I realized I hadn't met my daily dose of caffeine. I walked through the dining room, now quiet, between breakfast and lunch, and drew a cup of coffee from the urn on a counter. I sipped my coffee and looked at the spectacular view. The large dining room windows overlooked the green lawn that fell away like an infinity pool to the cobalt blue of Lake Superior. A mile or two from shore, a ship plowed through the cold water on its way to pick up taconite pellets in Duluth. The ship was so far off it was hard to tell it was making headway. There had been a newspaper article the previous week about a kid who jumped into the Duluth ship canal on a dare and was so cold he couldn't swim to the ladders spaced along the length of the canal. He'd been lucky because a fisherman pulled him out of the water before he slipped under the cold water. I flashed back to John Carr's story about Albie daring him to jump off the ore-loading docks and wondered if either of them would be alive if they'd actually made the jump. If the fall hadn't killed them, I wonder if they would have made it to shore before they were overcome by hypothermia. They might never have been found. As Gordon Lightfoot sang in The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, the big lake never gives up her dead. Peter, are you daydreaming? I turned and found Miriam Milam approaching with a tray. I like Miriam. I find her witty and smart, and I am amazed by her boundless energy and compassion. Whenever anyone was sick or had a personal tragedy, Miriam would buy a card and track down every member of the staff to get their signature. I hear you're working with Len to see who poisoned that woman in the city band, she said as she quickly set the salt and pepper on each table. The rumor mill must be broken, I said. She wasn't poisoned, she had an allergic reaction. Miriam stopped and cocked her head. Someone said that she was flopping like a bass. Are we having a conversation, or are you pumping me for information? Hard to say, she said, as she went back to setting out the salt and pepper. I heard you were giving her mouth to mouth. Miriam peeked over her shoulder to see how I reacted. Do you know Sheila O'Keefe? I asked. I've run into her a few times. Can't say I really know her, Miriam said, finishing her task and drawing a cup of coffee. Why do you ask? I'm just curious. She was the woman with the allergic reaction, and I was wondering how many people knew about her allergy to nuts. Miriam took a sip from her cup, obviously contemplating her words. Sheila is pretty well known around town, although not many people are what you'd call close friends. She's overly friendly sometimes. Wow, sounds like I should have been more careful than to give her mouth to mouth. Miriam's eyes sparkled. I guess that means Jenny won't have to worry about me stealing you away now that you're soiled goods. She got up and disappeared into the kitchen. I was pretty sure Jenny didn't need to worry about competition from Miriam, who was happily married. She was so busy with a farm and other ventures, I'm not sure how she found time to work at Whispering Pines, much less have time for an extramarital fling. I overheard her say once that she needed the job here, so she and her husband were covered by medical insurance and to smooth the budgetary ups and downs of a farm income. I went back to my office and leafed through the sheet music, all marches, for the next concert. I noted a few repeat songs from the fair concert, but most were new. I made a mental note to spend some time looking at the arrangements, then picked up the sign-up sheet for the van of residents going to the final day of the county fair. The list of residents in need of a ride was shorter. By Sunday, the fair winds down. The ribbons have been awarded in all the 4-H competitions, and the people are loading their projects in cars, trucks, and trailers to take them home. The Sunday highlight for many of my retirees is the discounting many food vendors offer so they don't have to cart the food away. I had 6 passengers in the van. 5 were residents, and the 6th was Wendy, who was coming along as the second chaperone. She sat behind me to bug me. "Peter, tell me about the woman who almost died after the concert," Wendy said, leaning over the rail that separated the driver from the passengers. "Sheila O'Keefe had an allergic reaction to a peanut." "I know that," Wendy said, waving her hand as if to sweep that fact away. "I want to know about her. I heard she's a cougar and is particularly attracted to men with wedding rings." "I can't help you out," I replied. "The first time I met her was at the concert." "But people must have warned you about her." I thought back to Brian's warning comments before the concert and my discussion with Miriam this morning. No, she was pretty much unknown to me before the concert. Man, you must live in a bunker somewhere where the sun doesn't shine and gossip doesn't penetrate, Wendy said with a grin. I work 60 hours a week, including most of my days off, and spend the rest of the time eating or sleeping. That doesn't leave a lot of time for rumor-mongering. Where do you find time to scrape up rumors? Whistling Pines is a great rumor mill, with all the old folks sitting around with lots of time to repeat or improve rumors. The people who still drive get into town and catch up on the local gossip, then share. The barbershop and the beauty parlor, I said. They're good, but people only go there every few weeks. I see a lot of little old men sitting around McDonald's in the morning drinking 99-cent coffee. The women seem to hang out more at the Vanilla Bean. Tell me, what do the town gossips say about Sheila O'Keefe? I asked. Like I told you, she's a cougar who likes to chase down younger men. Does she hang out in the bars? How would I know? Wendy asked. I've never seen her at the places my band plays, but that doesn't mean she's not drinking somewhere else. It took some time to unload all my passengers at the fairgrounds. Last off was Hulda Packer, who uses a walker to get around Whistling Pines, but is not mobile enough to use the walker at the fairgrounds with uneven ground and longer distances. I lowered her wheelchair from the van using the electronic lift and locked up. Peggy Warren, one of our newer residents, who was able to walk but not drive, walked along with us. The other 4 residents were all mentally and physically able to move about the fairgrounds by themselves. I want to see the 4-H building, Hulda blurted out. I'd never seen her hide her opinions or wishes. In some ways, I appreciated her frank input. In other ways, I sometimes wished she'd be quiet and let a few of life's inconveniences pass without comment. We pushed down a matted grass pathway past a few food vendors and a large building that housed vendors selling anything from Amway products to leaf-free replacement gutters. The aroma of grilling turkey legs and mini donuts filled the air. Darn it, Peter, Hulda said. You could steer around a few of the bumps. This wheelchair doesn't have tension bar suspenders. I grinned at Hulda's mangling of torsion bar suspension. She had a huge vocabulary, but got the words twisted all the time. Hulda, I think the phrase is torsion bar suspension. I know. That's what I said, she blurted in her outdoor voice. You know, I was married to an engineer who talked about technology like that all the time. I didn't know your husband was an engineer, I said, as I carefully skirted a rock jutting through the trampled grass. He was brilliant, Hulda said. He worked in the mines and had 5 patents for mining drills and devices he'd invented. Wow, I said. I don't think I've ever met anyone who had a patent. He was always tinkering with things around the house and in our cars. He took out all the little dashboard warning lights and installed gauges. He wanted to know the oil pressure was low before the idiot light told him he was on the verge of ruining the engine. That seems very wise, I said. It doesn't work if you've got a station wagon full of screaming kids, Hulda said. waving her arm for emphasis. I was busy trying to keep the kids from killing each other, but it was my fault. I didn't notice the little stinking needle on the stinking little gauge when it went to zero. I didn't notice a stinking thing until the stinking engine seized up and we sat in front of Dunnigan's pub with a car that wouldn't run. And then the engineer came driving up in his fancy pickup truck and had the nerve to point out which gauge I was supposed to watch for oil pressure. One of seven gauges he put in, none of them with labels. "What did you say?" I asked. I told him I was too busy seeing if any of the kids was bleeding or throwing up, and I didn't notice a gauge that showed zero. Then he said, "It doesn't matter which one you're looking at, dear. None of them should be zero." Peggy had been listening silently to the rant until that point. Now curious, she asked, "Did he hook up the idiot lights for you?" "Hell no. You know what the engineer did? He painted little red zones on the gauges and make little labels for them. Then he took me by my hand and showed me the fancy little gauges and said I should stop the car if any of the needles went into the red zone." "Did that work for you, Hulda?" Peggy asked. I told him if the needles went into the red zone, it was because he wasn't taking care of the car. I said it was not my job to watch the stinking little needles on the stinking little gauges. My job was to drive the car and keep the kids from killing each other. It was his job to make sure the little needles never went into the red end. "Here we are at the 4-H building," I said, as we rolled up the concrete apron leading into the steel pole barn that housed the 4-H exhibits. I was pleased that we could move on to other topics. We walked down the fibercraft aisle, rolling past hand-tatted doilies, embroidered dish towels and pillow covers, braided and hooked rugs, and cross-stitched and crewel-embroidered pictures. I stopped in front of a prize-winning quilt with a triple purple ribbon dangling from the top edge. The pattern was a sunburst with a yellow center and tiny patches radiating that went from yellow to oranges to reds as they got further from the center. I couldn't imagine the hours put into the cutting, arranging, and sewing to create a piece of art like I was viewing. "Whose quilt is this?" Hulda asked. "The quilter is Arlene Bartlett," I said, reading from a card next to the ribbon emblazoned with the title "Best in Show." "It looks like all her points match up and end perfectly at the border," Peggy said. "There's not a pucker anywhere, and Arlene didn't use any of those appliques." "She wins every year," Hulda said. "The judges should let someone else win once in a while." She pointed to the next quilt and said, "Who's the grand champion?" I wheeled ahead to the quilt with a single purple ribbon. It was nearly as intricate as the winner, with a patriotic theme involving red, white, and blue pieces sewn in a pattern that looked like a flapping American flag. I marveled at the vision it took to cut and arrange all the pieces in a manner that made the flag look like it was gently waving in a breeze. "Whose quilt is this?" she asked. "This one was quilted by Nancy Moore," I replied. "I hear she goes to those quilting retreats," Peggy said. "That used to be fun. We'd get a dozen women together and spend a weekend cutting pieces and talking." "I suppose she won by pandering with that patriotic theme," Hulda grumbled. "Some people will sink to any depth to win." "Who's the reserve champion, Peter?" Peggy asked. I wheeled Hulda down to a quilt featuring a bassoon made from hundreds of pieces of gold and yellow fabric in the center of the white quilt. Black musical notes were coming out of the instrument and the white background stitched to look like a piece of sheet music with tiny black notes crossing it. "Whose quilt is this?" Hulda asked. I looked at the card next to the pink reserve champion ribbon and was shocked. "Peter," Peggy said, "read us the name." "Sheila O'Keefe quilted this one," I said in amazement. "Never heard of her," Peggy said, standing close and examining the intricate pieces and the sewing of the reserve champion quilt. "The bassoon and the musical notes are all appliques. The background sheet music is just machine-sewn black thread on a white background. That's much easier than cutting and fitting all the pieces together like Arlene Bartlett does. She moved to the next quilt, a pretty pattern featuring a clump of purple coneflowers. The stitching was a little rougher and the points on the triangles around the perimeter gapped or were cut short where they met at the corners. "Is this one made by my niece?" she asked. "Her name is Ashley Warren." I checked the card next to the white honorable mention ribbon. Yes, this was made by Ashley. She got an honorable mention. Peggy looked at the quilts, winning the first three places, and then back at Ashley's piece. It's a pity that she didn't do better. Only the first three places go to the state fair, and she's been either second or third place for the last 5 years. She'll be fuming about being snubbed by the judges, and her finish doesn't qualify her for the fair. She paused and then added, "Maybe Ashley will take it better than I think. She told me it's a pain in the keister to enter the state fair competition. You have to make 3 trips to the fair. One trip to deliver the quilt on the day the fair opens, a second trip to look at all the competitors, and a third to pick up after the last day of the fair. That's a lot of time and gas money. Either that, or you have to spend big bucks to rent a hotel room for the whole 10 days and eat all your meals at restaurants or the fair. My granddaughter has a quilt here somewhere. Find Lisa Packer's quilt," Hulda requested, ignoring Peggy's comments. We rolled slowly down the row of quilts, looking at the amazing artistry and talking about the hundreds of hours the quilters had put into their creations, and kibitzing about the legality of using one of those fancy sewing machines versus hand-sewing all the pieces. "They should have separate quilting categories," Peggy opined. "It's not fair to put the machine-sewn quilts up against the hand-sewn ones." After reading dozens of recipe cards with the quilter's name and hometown, I found Lisa Packer's quilt. It was a simple pattern with 6-inch squares of earth tones bordered by a brown strip of fabric. The seams were mostly straight and obviously hand-sewn. A few of the stitches were puckered. I assumed that Lisa was one of the 4-H kids, and this was a really nice effort for her first attempt at quilting. A red ribbon hung from the top edge of the quilt. "This is Lisa's quilt," I said. Hulda studied the quilt and asked, "What's that ribbon say?" "The ribbon says second place, teen 13 to 18, home arts division." Hulda squirmed in the wheelchair and said, "Well, I suppose she could have won the adult division if they kept those professional quilters out of the competition." "Hulda, I think Lisa did a wonderful job with her quilt. She should be very proud of herself and her second place ribbon. She can enter it in the state fair." We wheeled past the rest of the quilts without comment, my mind going back to the third place quilt, thinking that quilting didn't seem to fit the little I knew of Sheila O'Keefe. We rolled slowly through the rest of the home arts exhibits, the garden vegetable and flower exhibits, where the entries were starting to look a little wilted after 4 days of sitting on tables, and stopped in front of a display of home-baked breads. "I bake bread for my family every day," Peggy said, eyeing the loaves, each with a sample slice lying next to the loaf. "These folks make all these fancy-shaped loaves with crisscross cuts on top and weird grains. I made white bread in bread pans, the kind you can make a sandwich from that will keep you full until supper time." "Will you look at that," Hulda said. "They have a category for machine-made bread. Why give someone a prize for dumping ingredients into a machine? 90% of the work is kneading the dough to the right texture." We rolled past canned goods and Hulda pointed to a row of canning jars containing meat. "Look at that, they give prizes for canning venison. All you do is stick the deer pieces in a jar, cover them with water, and put them in the pressure canner for an hour. Where's the art in that?" "The trick is not opening the pressure cooker too early," Peggy explained. "Otherwise, the jars blow up." "That was never a problem at my house," Hulda explained. The engineer put gauges on everything. We had a gauge on the pressure cooker, and he told me never to even think about opening it until a little arrow was at the bottom. We never had an undercooked or overcooked turkey, roast, or chicken, because he had little thermometers to stick in them to make sure the temperature was perfect. It was enough to drive a sane person crazy. He always said, if there's a way to measure something, I can make a gauge for it. Peggy shook her head. I wish I'd had someone handy around the house. We had leaking faucets and broken appliances, and my husband couldn't fix anything. My husband always said the only thing he couldn't fix were broken bones and broken hearts, Hulda replied. If there was nothing broken in our house, he was over helping the neighbors fix a lawnmower or a broken latch on a screen door. He did it all. After a pause, she added, he found out later he couldn't fix his angry wife after he spent a little too much time helping the widow down the block. I nearly had him fixed after that. The conversation died abruptly as we rolled over to the mini-donut hut and shared a dozen of the deep-fried, cinnamon-dipped delicacies. After my experience the first day of the fair, I was reluctant to push Hulda's wheelchair through the barn. As we got nearer, Hulda asked, is this where Tinker got injured the other day? Is he out of the hospital yet? Yes, this is where Tinker got bumped by the gate, I said. Tinker's back home again, Peggy added. I saw him at breakfast this morning. You know, he was quite a fix-it man around town. That's why everybody called him Tinker. I called him a couple of times to fix things. I was surprised to hear Tinker was home, considering he was still in the ICU in the most recent report. I looked at Peggy's thick glasses and realized she could have mistaken almost anyone for Tinker who was still hospitalized and would be for a while. Show me where he got injured, Hulda demanded, before I could correct Peggy. As we neared the barn, we passed a booth with a wood sign that said, Handmade Amish Toys. A young man with a thin blonde beard was packing a box with wooden train cars. Each appeared to be hand-carved with small lathe-cut wheels. Behind him was a small table with an array of small handmade wood toys that looked like guns with a star-shaped wheel atop them. Excuse me, I said to the young man. What are these? I pointed to the toys with the star-shaped wheel. Oh, those are rubber band guns, he said. He picked up one and quickly threaded a rubber band on three star points, then pointed it at a target painted on the tarpaulin at the back of his booth and pulled the trigger three times. Each time he pulled the trigger, a rubber band snapped off the star wheel, smacked the target, and the wheel advanced, ready for the next shot. He reloaded the wheel and handed it to me. I missed the target with the first rubber band, then adjusted and struck the target with the remaining two rubber bands. Have you sold many of these? I asked as Hulda fidgeted in the wheelchair. He shrugged. I haven't been in the booth the whole time, but I think we probably sold a dozen or more.
The past 2 weeks' episodes of this program can be listened to from the ktwh.org website. Simply click on Literally from the North Shore from the program's drop-down menu found at the top of the homepage to listen to the archived shows.